The Poetry of Emily Grossholtz, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Poet and philosopher Emily Grossholtz is here now to read from and talk about her new book, a collection of poems entitled Eden.
I discovered the title for this book, Eden, actually at the very last minute, but retrospectively I realized that in the poems in this book, there are a lot of gardens, and there are a lot of poems about childhood. When I was writing this book, my husband and I were starting our family, so I was thinking about my own children. Uh-huh. I was thinking about my childhood. I was even thinking about the childhood of my parents.
Poet Emily Grossholtz. She'll be back in just a moment to talk about and read four of the poems in her new book, a collection entitled Eden. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. As a teacher of philosophy and a practicing poet, Emily Grossholtz is a person who moves among several worlds. She's a professor of philosophy at Pennsylvania State University. She's also the author of three highly praised collections of poetry. In her work as a philosopher, she explores 17th century Europe and the thinking of scientists like Galileo and Newton and philosophers like Descartes and Leibniz. As a poet, she's alive to popular and academic culture in the 1990s. Yet for Emily Grossholtz, the worlds of philosophy and poetry are not polarities but complementary. Her most recent book is a collection of lyric, narrative, and epistolary poems entitled Eden. Emily Grossholtz takes us on a pilgrimage from the innocence of childhood through alienation and loss to an earthly paradise regained by way of devotion to family and the pursuit of her art. It's a pilgrimage that moves through many locales but has its center in the poet's heartland, Philadelphia, and the backcountry of Pennsylvania and New York. It's also a journey punctuated by meditations on solitude, separation, and death, but enlivened by the pleasures of love and motherhood. Emily Grossholtz has taught at Breadloaf and the Swanee Writers Conference, is an editor for the Hudson Review, and has received fellowships from the National Humanities Center and the Guggenheim Foundation. Over the next few minutes, she'll read and discuss four of the poems in her new collection. The first poem you'll hear from Eden is called On Spadina Avenue.
Driven by love and curiosity, I entered the painted shops along Toronto's Chinatown and lingered in one red pharmacy where every label was printed in mysterious characters. Beside myself, not knowing what I stopped for, I read the scrolling dragons, roots, and flowers, intelligible as nature, and quizzed the apothecary on her products. Lovesick for my husband. She was puzzled, for how could I explain my private fevers to a perfect stranger? I questioned her obliquely, hit or miss. Lady, what's this button full of powder? What's this ointment in the scaly tube? Who are these dry creatures in the basket, and how are they applied? The deer tails gleamed in fat, uneven rows. Unrolled seahorses darkened on the shelves, and other customers with clearer motives stepped in behind my back. I couldn't say. His troublesome male beauty assails me sometimes, watching him at night next to the closet door, half-dressed or naked on the bed beside me. An evening amorousness keeps me awake for hours brooding, even after love. How fast in time we are. How possibly my love could quit this world and pull down half of heaven when he goes. The patient Chinese lady has no cure and serves her other customers in order. Across the curled up, quiet ochre lizards, giant starfish, quince, and ginger root, she turns to look at me. We both know I'm not ill with this or that, but suffer from a permanent condition, a murmur of the heart itself calling me out of dreams to verify my warm, recurrent husband, who turns and takes me in his arms again and sleepily resumes his half of heaven. ¶¶ I really did spend quite a bit of time in Chinatown when I was up in Toronto at the University of Toronto. And I would go into the pharmacies and really spend a lot of time looking at the boxes on the shelves and the things on the counters. However, I couldn't say that everything in the poem actually was there mm-hmm. on the shelf. I put a few extra items in.
The deer tails.
No, the deer tails really were there.
They were really there.
And it's interesting because in the intervening years since I wrote that poem, I've actually gotten to know quite a few Chinese people, and I've gotten to know something about Chinese medicine. And what was utterly mysterious when I wrote that poem now makes a lot more sense to me.
Well, now, what was the nature of that mysteriousness? That is to say, lovesickness? What's at the heart of the poem, so to speak?
Well, in a sense, something very simple, that all the medicines were labeled in Chinese.
Uh-huh.
But also because the Chinese system of medicine is really very different from Western medicine, and there's no way to get your bearings. So that the mysteriousness of that shop did somehow correspond to the strangeness of being in love and the way in which you move through it partly by instinct and a lot not knowing what you're doing.
Well, isn't it the case that much of what we now call medicine today, even in the West, originated with vegetables and poisons and potions and things like that? So
mm-hmm.
it is very distant from our modern medical technology, and yet, what, only 100 years or so separates us from that kind of thinking about how people cure themselves
right.
in their emotions and in their hearts.
And actually, in fact, also in the intervening years, I have had developed some interest in herbal medicine,
uh-huh.
and I take it very seriously, and I give myself herbs, and I give my children herbs.
Emily, in this poem on Spadina Avenue, you use the word quince. Now, I'm going to suggest a bit of a leap here to you. That reminds me of a wonderful John Keats poem, The Eve of St. Agnes, which
mm-hmm.
is so palpable that you can almost feel it and touch it.
Yes.
Are we on the right track here, that there's some Keats at work in this poem?
Yes, I think that there's Keats at work in the whole book, and indeed in most of my poetry. Keats is a poet that I've read since I was very young, and I've memorized a great deal of Keats, and I think that Keatsian vocabulary and Keatsian cadences turn up in my poems all the time.
Speaking of Keats, Emily, do you think of yourself as a poet? I mean, in what formal way do you come to poetry? We could go through the poems in this book and look for A, B, C, D, C, D, C, D, E, F, and all of that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The poems are very relaxed. They sort of flow off the page. How do you compose them with regard to formal requirements and,
mm-hmm.
and all of that?
Well, the formal considerations that shape my poems, I think, are primarily metrical. For a long time, I have had a tendency to write in iambic pentameter. And one thing that I do to keep the iambic pentameter interesting and moving is to throw in trimeter lines
uh-huh.
in between the pentameter.
So this is a conscious kind of thing when you're playing around with
yes,
words.
Yes, it's become conscious over the years. And I am interested in rhyme, and I try it rhyme occasionally, but my rhymes more often tend to be slant, because I find it very hard to write in full rhyme and not make it sound jingly,
uh-huh.
especially now at the end of the 20th century.
Is it the personal experience that comes first for you, or the imaginative dimension when you put the two together and you say, well, it's time to write a poem, or
mm-hmm.
something trips something in your mind? How does that work?
Mm-hmm. I usually write something down in a very half-formed way, though at this point, iambic pentameter is my default mode, so it often comes out in something close to that.
Yeah.
And then I will go back and, for example, I will equalize the number of lines in every stanza,
uh-huh.
or I will impose something on the pentameter to make it more interesting, or I will work up the rhyme so that there's more of it and it's more full.
Uh-huh. Let's talk about another poem here in your collection, Eden, Emily Grossholtz. I'm going to ask you to read to us again. This is a poem called Life of a Salesman. This is deeply personal, like the first one you read to us.
Yes, it is. My father was an alcoholic. Then he was in AA for really a number of years. And then he went back to drinking. So all those stages of his life are something that I have brooded over to a certain extent. My father had a literary theatrical side, and he was in plays as an amateur actor, mm-hmm. and his favorite play was Death of a Salesman. And that's why I gave the poem its title, because I was trying to remember the part of my father's life that was strong and positive.
All right, let's hear this poem, Emily.
Behind the small fixed windows of the album, my father sits on sand, floured with sea salt, nestling my younger brothers on his knees, my mother beside him, me on another towel. Or else he's smiling, lapped by shallow combers, holding the kids so only their toes get wet, free from booze and taxes, the city office, his territory, miles of empty highway. My husband, late addition to the family, ports out a disproportion. That generic photo of my father on the beaches stands for a man with 2 weeks paid vacation. I say to my brothers, look, you're all contented. Both of you blue with cold in your ratty towels, thrilled with the wind, the escalating waves, our father watching the ocean roll at sevens. Most of the time, he's on the road again, selling fancy letterhead, engravings the businessmen he calls on can't be certain they need without his powers of persuasion. He tries to tell them, 50 weeks a year, in sun and rain and snow, on secondary arteries cross-hatching the back country of Pennsylvania, Maryland, West Virginia. Alone at night in one more shabby diner, his pale self in the speckled mirror panels is like a stranger's. He coats his potatoes and minute steak in ketchup for the color. He wants a drink, but holds off for another day, another hour. The gray Atlantic shuffles invisibly. He orders coffee and maybe calls his sponsor up long distance. Or calls my mother next with lonely questions she tries to answer, putting on my brothers who sneeze and whistle, practice words like daddy that touch him at the end of the connection. The dial tone doesn't sound at all like waves. He might go to a movie or a meeting. There's always one around to fill the shady, dangerous intervals of middle evening. He likes the coffee's warmth, the sound of voices circling in on wisdom. Know the difference. Protect him, higher power, when he travels his 100 miles tomorrow, rain or shine. His death lies elsewhere, hidden in the future, far from his wife and children, far away from cleanly riffled Jersey shores in summer, the gray Atlantic playing out its hand.
Emily, you have just read to us your poem, Life of a Salesman. Is this a way for you to talk to somebody across the distance, whether it's spatial or emotional? How does that work?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's certainly addressing my father after his death.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a poem of coming to terms with my father.
Saying things what? That were difficult to say when the opportunity was there?
Well, I think if you're a child dealing with an alcoholic parent, for a while all you can see is the alcoholism.
Mm.
And so I was trying to remember the fact that he worked very hard to support his family. He had a hard life while he was working, being a salesman on the road all the time. And that he really did stick with AA for a good long time and worked hard at that.
Is it too much of a stretch, Emily, to say that these poems that you have written in this collection, is this a therapeutic exercise, not only as you look at your father, for example, writing this poem about him, but for yourself, a way to come to terms with angels and demons, all of that?
To a certain extent, I think that this poem is the closest that you would... I would say that this poem is the closest to a therapeutic poem in the volume. Certainly when you are re-beginning your life, as I was when I was writing this book, getting married, starting a family, there are many things that you have to come to terms with and sift through, and I think that there's an expression of that in these poems.
Emily Grossholtz, we're talking about your collection of poems, Eden. I would like for you to read again now. This is a poem called 36 Weeks. It's about pregnancy. How about it?
Well, I really did write this poem when I was about 36 weeks pregnant, which is when you're getting to be rather large.
Uh-huh.
And also the point when the baby is really quite active and there's a certain kind of communication between you and the baby. In this case, as I note, he had his knees up at the top of my stomach, and he would regularly go bang, 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 and I'd go pat, pat, pat.
You'd look down there and carry on a conversation, huh?
Yes.
And the baby was hearing voices. That's a line that'll come up in the poem. Let's pause for a moment and read the poem, and then we'll talk about it.
Ringed like a tree or planet, I've begun to feel encompassing, and so must seem to my inhabitant, who wakes and sleeps in me and has his being, who'd like to go out walking after supper, although he never leaves the dining room, timid, insouciant, dancing on the ceiling. I'm his roof, his walls, his musty cellar lined with untapped bottles of blue wine, his beach, his seashell combers tuned to the minor tides of my placenta, wound in the single chamber of my whorl. His park, a veiny meadow, plumped and watered for his ruminations. A friendly climate, sun and rain combined in one warm season underneath my heart. Beyond my infinite dark sphere of flesh and fluid, he can hear two voices talking. His mother's alto and his father's tenor aligned in conversation. Two distant voices singing beyond the pillars of his archaic Mediterranean, reminding him to dream the emerald outness of a brave new world. Sail, little craft, at your appointed hour, your head the prow, your lungs the sails and engine, belly the seaworthy hold, and see me face to face. No world, no palace, no Egyptian goddess starred over heaven's poles. Only your pale, impatient, opened mother, reaching to touch you after the long wait. Only one of two beside your father, speaking a language soon to be your own. And strangely, brightly clouding out behind us, at last you'll recognize the greater earth you used to take me for, ocean of air and orbit of the skies.
Emily, you've just read to us 36 weeks. Tell me about the conversation between you and little Benjamin.
Well, as I understand it, babies in the last month or so, maybe the last few months of the term, really do hear quite a bit. And they respond to certain kinds of stimulus, and they push out, and you pat in. One thing that's interesting to me about that poem is that the landscape that comes in is Mediterranean.
Why was that? Were you having dreams about Mediterranean beaches when you were pregnant with little Benjamin? What happened?
No, I don't think so. I think it is because the Mediterranean is one geographic locus that my poetry comes back to again and again and again in a whole variety of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I think both for spiritual reasons and for formal reasons, I have a collection of tropes that are Mediterranean, and when I'm writing about something really important,
mm-hmm.
the Mediterranean acts like a magnet and brings the language close to it.
Does it have anything to do with the fact that you also make your living as a philosopher, and we look back to the Greeks and the Mediterranean and the beginnings of what we call philosophy in the West? Is that too much of a leap?
I don't think so. I mean, There have been a number of times when my professional life has taken me to the Mediterranean, to Rome, to Greece, to Jerusalem, and I do experience those places as full of philosophers.
Right.
The ghosts of philosophers.
Is this a philosophical poem in any sense, Emily? It's at one level, it's just you and that baby talking back and forth. But is there philosophy at work too?
I think so, in the sense that all of the poems in this last section that have to do with the beginning of Benjamin's life also have to do with language. And they have to do with the relationship between nature and culture, and how fluid and yet how unavoidable that boundary is. And one thing that's odd about an unborn baby is you would think that an unborn baby would be a bit of nature. And yet I experienced Benjamin as already caught up in the nets of language as soon as I started to have any kind of communication with him at all, before he was born.
Mm-hmm. Emily, your new collection of poetry is called Eden, and I would like you now please to read the title poem.
In lurid cartoon colors, the big baby dinosaur steps backwards under the shadow of an approaching Tyrannosaurus Rex. His mommy going to fix it, you remark, serenely anxious, hoping for the best. After the big explosion, after the lights go down inside the house and up the street, we rush outdoors to find a squirrel stopped in straws of half-gnawed cable. I explain, trying to fit the facts, the squirrel is dead. No, you explain it otherwise to me. He's sleeping, and his mommy going to come. Later, when the squirrel has been removed, his mommy fix him, you insist, insisting on the right to know what you believe. The world is truly full of fabulous, great, and curious small inhabitants, and you're the freshly minted, unashamed Adam in this garden. You preside, appreciate, and judge our proper names. Like God, I brought you here. Like God, I seem to be omnipotent, mostly helpful, sometimes angry as hell. I fix whatever minor faults arise with band-aids, batteries, masking tape, and pills. But I am powerless, as you must know, to chase the serpent sliding in the grass, or the tall angel with the flaming sword who scares you when he rises suddenly behind the gates of sunset.
Emily, we've just heard you read your poem, Eden. There's a lot of imagery, a lot of thematic, not contradiction, but a lot going on in this poem. Tell me about it.
Well, this poem was made out of very diverse materials and also out of a conversation that I had with my son. It starts out with an episode from the cartoon DuckTales.
Right.
And it ends up with the Bible. But hey, when you're living with small children, somehow that makes sense.
Yeah, this is the 90s. What the heck? How do you make that journey?
Well, there were a number of different instances in which the fact of death or the threat of death came up. And it was just when Benjamin was starting to speak. And it was interesting that he both refused to learn the word or understand the concept. And I had the feeling at the same time that he was blocking it, that at some level he did understand it, and he was just willing not to. And in the end, I decided not to fuss at him about it, and to when he said, this is not death, just to let it go. But then I wrote this poem about that.
Well, there's the teacher in you coming to the fore. In other words, yeah. You are, again, after all, a professor of philosophy. Speaking of teaching, Emily, let me ask you to consider this as we move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Do you have a responsibility as a poet? I mean, obviously, you sit there at the word processor or at the page, and you do your thing, speak to yourself, as it were. But what about, to the larger world outside of your poetry itself?
Well, I think if there's anything useful about my poetry, it has to do with the shape of my life, not as the shape of my life, but as an exemplary shape. And by that I mean, a lot of my early poems were about traveling. So that I took the Odysseus motif, and I did it. And I was a young woman. I didn't stay at home weaving. And I guess now the other thing is that I have a family that I like and small children that I like, and at the same time I have a variety of other intellectual and cultural activities that engage me very much.
So this
and,
makes this
and they
makes...
all cohabit. They're not. I mean, I'm tired and busy a lot, but there doesn't seem to be any essential conflict.
Uh-huh.
It all mixes up together as it does in that poem, Eden.
Well, I was thinking this makes of you both Odysseus and Penelope. You're going and coming and having the traffic and embracing several worlds at one time.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Emily, I want you to know how much I admire this book of poems that you have put together and how grateful I am for your willingness to come and talk on Soundings. The book is called Eden. It is a collection of poems available from the Johns Hopkins University Press. Emily Grossholtz, you are a professor of philosophy at Penn State, and it's great to have you back at the Humanities Center. Good luck in your work.
Thank you, sir.
You're listening to Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was Emily Grossholtz, a poet and philosopher who teaches at Pennsylvania State University. For an audio cassette of this program, send $10 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 714. That's program number 714. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Next week on Soundings, Creationism and the Secular World. Anthropologist Christopher Toomey will be here to talk about his new book, God's Own Scientists. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program came from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.